Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you commentary and our opinion for today's economic and political events. It's Thursday, March 25th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody.
Well, let's see. What a great day. It's a beautiful day here on the Eastern Shore. Nice, sunny sunshine. Tomorrow, though, it's going to be windy. Already giving us warnings of a lot of wind, so beware out there. So gold today, we were positive most of the day. Markets were down big earlier in the day until the president spoke with promises of money. Trillions and trillions of dollars that are going to be spent. So goody, goody, goody. So that reversed the markets, put a little pressure on gold. Maybe there were some other things, but I think that was the main thing that made it turn around. Gold was down $8 today at $17.27. Silver's down just 3 pennies at $25.15. Platinum was down 25 at $1,151. Palladium was down 13 at $2,686. The USDX today, of course, was stronger, 0.23 at 92.82. Crude oil was down 2.67 at 58.51. And let's see. Let's go and get to the paper markets. And you had, again, as I mentioned, you had the Dow down, I think, about 300 points earlier in the day. And, of course, it reversed itself. And we're looking at the Dow, 200 points plus, 32,620. I know I'm a little early, so we'll see this adjustment here. But the NASDAQ was, you know, up a couple points, 15 at just slightly below 13,000 at 12,977. And the S&P was up 20 at 3,909. So they even took back some of the big gains right after the reversal, but still in positive territory. You had 10-year yield, 1.73%. Again, pressure on Japan, 2%. Yeah, that's about it. And, again, there's lots of things to talk about today. And so let's go ahead and get started today. Again, was a good day for unemployment insurance. That fell sharply last week, hoping that signs of the economy is picking up. Jobless claims totaled 684,000 for the week, ending March 20th. And this is the first time it was below 700,000 during the pandemic. And the level was a substantial decline from the 781,000 from March 13th. And, of course, was the lowest since March 14th, 2020. A separate release this morning showed that the fourth quarter GDP was a little stronger than previously reported. The third and final reading showed a gain of 4.3%. Most of those estimates out there were about 1.4, so not that far off. And I don't know. I guess that's pretty much it, Dave, that I have for that report. Would you like to?
Yeah, there are a couple more things. The most recent weekly claims total marks the first time that it's less than the pre-pandemic record of 695,000 hit all the way back in October of 1982. In addition to the drop in first-time weekly claims, continuing claims, which run a week behind, declined to under 4 million. That's a drop of 264,000 from the prior week. Now, the total of those still receiving job benefits did spike to nearly 19 million, although those data run 2 weeks behind the claims number. So I guess labor economists are expecting that to come down in the coming 2 weeks as well. Now, While the claims numbers overall remain high by historical standards, we see that the job situation is a little bit better than a year ago, although we're still far away from a definitive rebound, Melody, much less any recovery that people continue to talk about, particularly those promoting the stock markets. Now, 1 year ago, claims totaled 3.3 mil before exploding higher to almost 7 million a week later as companies laid off workers amid all the shutdowns across the country. Of course, weekly claims wouldn't fall below 1 mil until the end of August. And at least 22.4 million workers would lose their jobs in just March and April. Although they tell us that about 13 million of those jobs have been recovered since then. Now, despite somewhat stronger jobs picture, Fed Chair, or perhaps because of how weak it's been up until just this past week, Fed Chair indicated this morning that the Fed will continue its aggressive policies to keep growth pushing higher. We'll talk a little bit more about that later in the program, Melody.
Okay. Well, you know, the money flowing into stock ETFs are at a record level. And again, it looks like irrational exuberance is alive and well, Dave.
Yeah. That's so.
Oh, money flows into equity funds have gone on a record-setting streak in recent weeks, as investors' mindsets have moved from fearing a downturn in the markets to fear of missing out of the big returns. To me, that always sounds like, isn't that a bubble?
Yeah,
isn't that the definition of a bubble? Anyway, record sums of cash, they've flown into equity funds over the last month and a half. And the week ending March 17th, net $54 billion flowed into equity funds, with $43 billion going into the U.S. funds, equity funds. This was all according to the Investment Company Institute. The ICI's data showed net fund flows to equities were negative in 22 of the last 23 months. So that means that the investors were actually pulling money out of stocks, Dave.
Yeah, and in a majority of those months, Melody, that money was flowing into gold and silver and other places, cryptocurrencies, I'm afraid, too, although most of it to gold ETFs as opposed to physical gold and silver. But for some, I guess our consolation is, well, you've got to start somewhere. But really, ladies and gentlemen, if you want the real thing, you got to get with the bullion. Most of the listeners of this show know that already. You've got physical gold and silver in your actual possession.
I just wanted to say something there. You know, it's interesting to see that these numbers that have flowed into gold and silver through the gold ETFs, if you through your financial planners and so forth. And I just had a call this morning from a customer. He was inquiring. I think it was an Edward Jones account. It was an IRA, and you know, we were talking about it and what he should do, and he wanted to pull the metal out. And I says, well, are you sure you have metal? Because I didn't know Edward Jones actually had physical gold and silver IRAs. He says, well, no, there was a certain percentage in gold and a certain percentage in silver. I said, that's good. I says, but do you have physical metal there or stored in a depository, or is it an ETF? So again, folks, the whole point, and he's going to check on it. The point is, and this is a very well financially educated person, but he still didn't know or wasn't sure what metal that they were actually holding for him. You really have to be involved in your investments. You really have to know what you have. And so many of us just trust that they're going to take good care of us and position us properly. And it just, I don't know, I just thought it was a great example to let you know, you should know what you have. Are the ETFs? Is it physical? Where is it if it's physical? Are you in future contracts? Are you in options? Are you in stocks? So there was no explanation for what he had holding the physical. And that's what these financial planners do, because they know a lot of people, a large percentage of their customers, really want physical gold and silver, but that they don't sell it. So ETFs came along. They've got shares they can sell, and they make people think that you're holding gold. You're not. You're holding paper. So, and there is a difference. So always keep that in mind. All right, Dave, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I
do. No. That's important stuff. I mean, the only thing really I was going to add to this article was that Investment Company Institute data show that commodity funds have also seen 6 straight weeks of net outflows, even as the main commodity index has outperformed all the major U.S. stock indexes except the Dow during that time. So hang in there, ladies and gentlemen. The turnaround is coming. You're not investing in gold and silver for the short-term gains anyway. You're there because it's real money and because you're there for the long run. Always remember that.
And we talk a lot about inflation, of course, on this program. Gold is, one of the, fundamentals of gold is a hedge against inflation. And there was a survey from Civic Science, and it showed that more than 3/4 of American consumers, they're beginning to get it. More than 2 in 5, or 42% of these respondents, said they were very concerned, which was more than double the share. 17% said that they were not concerned at all, and this is in reference to inflation. As we've talked about many times, inflation is a self-fulfilling prophecy and is driven largely by expectations. It's a monetary policy. It's fiat dollars. The more money you have, the more money you print, the less valuable it becomes. And so when people expect costs to rise, they behave accordingly. They demand higher pay, raise rents, increase the cost of goods and services. All of those things push inflation higher, but that's not what really creates inflation. Perhaps this survey's most interesting data point is that young people who have never experienced runaway inflation, they're the ones that are most worried, maybe because they have the least amount of money anymore.
To begin with.
I mean, they don't have jobs. They're living at home longer. Gen Z reports that they are very concerned at the highest rate, although overall concern is greatest among people between 35 and 54. So, people are beginning to wake up, but I think they're beginning to feel the pinch in the pocketbook. Dave.
Yeah, well, the public looks to finally be catching up to at least market participants in their concerns about inflation and responding to rising prices, especially for rents and gasoline. Those jumped by 9% and 9.6% in February, respectively. Investors have been selling off treasuries recently, pushing yields on government debt to their highest levels since January of last year, and sending 5-year break-even inflation rates to the highest since 2008 last week. Now, the break-even rate is the difference between the yield of a bond and an inflation-linked bond at the same maturity. That's important because since investors' money is on the line, they have an interest in pricing inflation correctly. So what's particularly important about that is, the Fed getting what it wants with rising inflation, or so it speaks. I think it's in a big delusion. But they economists think the Fed's desires will push the PCE, which is personal consumption index, the Fed's favorite inflation gauge, above the central bank's 2% target. But whether inflation will actually remain there and not spike to problematic levels, say reported levels of 6%, which, by the way, is where it's closer to, or actually is, remains to be seen. Now, more about this also later in the program, Melody. Things are not always what they appear to be. And that's, I think, more than a lot of the other metrics, is why investors in the paper markets should be really concerned.
I think so, too. And, you know, and usually what happens is we just kind of sit and wait. If nothing is, you know, like last March happening, we just become and thinking that everything's okay and, you know, we're all right. We see the numbers. We see the numbers on the statement, but we don't realize how much less they're buying.
Yeah, really.
So with your bank accounts, yeah, you might have that. You might have $500,000. What's it buying today versus a year ago? So you don't realize how much you're losing, and that's the whole point. You know, we talk a lot about restaurants and how bad they're doing, and so many of them are closing, and we're not quite sure how many will be reopening, but many are closed for good. And here's another area that you know, we don't talk much about, and that's the fitness centers. They're also in trouble. Well, that might be a good thing, though, Dave.
Not what? Out of sight, out of pain. I mean, out of...
yeah. You know, well, there's less places to go to exercise. So. No, and I just teasing. But they're also, according to a report that surveyed nearly 12,000 gym members, the data over the past year is clear the situation hasn't improved for them. The cancellation rates rose from 12% during the initial lockdowns to almost 30% now. You have 55%, almost 56% of members have either canceled or paused their membership since a year ago. Even though half of gym members said they would return after the lockdowns, 30% have gone back as of August, and 71% are not exercising at the gym. Hey, that came up quick. We'll be back here in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. As we begin this second segment, let's talk about Wall Street news. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, has opened an inquiry into Wall Street's blank check acquisition frenzy and is seeking information on how underwriters at these banks are managing all the risks involved. The SEC has sent letters to too big to fail banks seeking info on their special purpose acquisition companies, or SPAC. SPACs are shell companies that raise funds to acquire a private company with the purpose of taking it public, allowing such targets to sidestep a traditional initial public offering. The SEC wants info on SPAC deal fees, volumes, and what controls banks have in place to police the deals internally, and is asking questions relating to compliance, reporting, and internal controls. Wall Street's biggest gold rush of recent years, SPACs, have surged globally to a record $170 billion this year, up from last year's total of $157 billion. The boom has been fueled in part by easy money conditions as the Fed and central banks around the world have pumped cash into pandemic-hit economies. The SPAC structure provides these startups with an easier path to go public and less regulatory scrutiny than the traditional IPO route. But the frenzy has started to encounter greater skepticism among investors with first-day trading share price jumps for SPACs fading. Investors have actually sued eight companies that combined with SPACs in the first quarter this year. Another big concern is the heightened risk of insider trading between when a SPAC goes public and when it announces its acquisition target. Not sure where all this goes, ladies and gentlemen, but it's about time we get a closer look at the details. We'll be back to you in the coming weeks and months as we learn more information. Now, here's a story that's topping a lot of news media headlines the past few days. The Suez Canal is still blocked today, one of the biggest shipping lanes in the Middle East. And according to some estimates, almost $10 billion worth of global shipping traffic per day is being disrupted. I don't know if you've seen the satellite photos, but this boat, the Ever Given, just crossed diagonally across virtually the entire width of the canal. Everyone knows by now there's been a massive logistical problem and delays at international ports this year. That comes amid surging demand for goods. But there's another way that this incident, beyond just the symbolism in these crazy times, say a lot about global shipping. The Ever Given, again, that's the name of the vessel that stuck, is longer than the Eiffel Tower. And it's one of the largest container ships in the world. There's another photo I saw today of taken from the ground behind a couple of, it looked like three, four, five-story apartments, hotels, and condos, and literally overshadowing those buildings is this behemoth container with all of its stacked cargo containers. In recent years, the shipping industry has made big bets on gigantic ships in an attempt to wring more efficiency out of the shipping system. But that's been actually a contributor to logistical problems. Mark Levinson, who's author of The Box, which is a book about the shipping container, said, "Ship lines, like companies in many other industries, have relentlessly pursued economies of scale. To them, bigger was better." And it was true. When you could build a ship that could carry 3,000 containers instead of, say, 2,000, the cost per container dropped. In fact, it dropped a lot. And when you could build a ship that could carry 10 rather than 5, the cost container was much lower. So ship lines were aggressively pursuing economies of scale. What they didn't count on was that at some point the vessels would get so big that diseconomies of scale would kick in. And that's what happened. What's happened in shipping, the point at which ships got built beyond what they say is 17 or 18,000 TEUs, that stands for 20-foot equivalent units. That sounds pretty big to me, with the point at which they just got too big. And that's when you started to have all this confusion in the ports here and abroad. And that's when experts say you start to have these delays in shipping. And that's when you start to have the entire industry become less reliable. And that diminished reliability is one of the things that's leading manufacturers and retailers to have a new sourcing pattern, just to make their products in different places and to have redundant value chains. With supply chains now so slow, the big winners in this current moment, the smaller, faster cargo ships, which are used by the more nimble players. So it turns out that the crisis in the Suez is partly just a fluke, but it's also perfectly emblematic of a broader problem in an industry that bet big on gigantic ships that are now contributing to growing logistical challenges all around the world. Interesting insight there, ladies and gentlemen. You're hearing it on Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, back here in the States, in Washington, in fact, the past couple days, Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, and Fed Chair Jerome Powell have been yakking back and forth with a congressional committee. Yesterday, Yellen told that committee that banks have improved their capital positions, and listen to this, ought to be allowed to continue to buy back their own stocks. The Fed, you know, we know, restricted share repurchases last year for too big to fail institutions and as a precautionary measure after COVID-19 reached pandemic status. And after those banks passed the pandemic-focused stress test in December, the Fed said it would allow buybacks to resume, though with some restrictions. Here are Yellen's words. "I have been opposed earlier when we were very concerned about the situation the banks would face about stock buybacks." But she added that financial institutions look healthier now, and I believe they should have some of the liberty provided by the rules to make returns to shareholders. Yeah, Janet, fake returns, propped up returns, returns that just make them look better. Make them look better as their earnings, their stocks are dozens of times higher than their actual earnings. It's just stupid. Anyway, banks are expected to start the buyback resumption as the buyback restrictions ease by the end of this month. One industry analyst said that after financial sector companies repurchased just $81 billion worth of their shares last year. That number will likely significantly increase. Of that $81 billion, $47 came in the restriction period, before the restriction period started. In 2020, S&P companies approved $520 billion in buybacks, a 29% decline from 2019. Now, the largest banks still have restrictions. They won't be able to return shareholders more than they made in profits the previous year. So, you know, that's a start, and that's a good thing, but I think it doesn't go far enough. You know, the fact that they're able to resume the buybacks because they showed in December that they could weather worst-case scenarios around the pandemic, I think is just a little bit premature and short-sighted. Fed officials have largely praised the industry's pandemic response and said too big to fail companies, banks, remain well capitalized. However, some, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, said she doesn't think regulators are going far enough. Specifically, she suggested to Yellen that BlackRock, the institutional money manager giant and leading ETF provider, also should be designated as a systemically important financial institution known as SIFI or SIFI. I like to call it SIFI because that's kind of what it is. Under post-Great Recession regulations, a SIFI is a firm that could put the economy at risk if it were to collapse. Now, BlackRock's the largest money manager in the world, with almost $9 trillion in assets. The firm, in fact, last year helped guide the Fed when it was buying corporate bonds. But Yellen said, it's not obvious to me that the SIFI designation would be the correct tool to address risks posed by asset management firms like BlackRock. She did say that examining the issue will be part of the work she does with the Financial Stability Oversight Council in the coming days and weeks. So we'll see what happens there, and we'll keep you abreast of developments in this area. Now, Richmond Fed Prez lost in this week's headline testimony from Powell and Yellen has been comments by Tom Barkin. He's the Richmond Fed president, that the economy is recovering from the recession, but some economic scarring may take a long time to heal. Now, economic scarring, he says, refers to the damage left behind by crises that will suppress growth prospects over the medium or long term. He told attendees at this year's Credit Suisse Asian Investment Conference, I'm hopeful we're on the brink of completing this recovery. Excess savings, and this is still his words, excess savings and fiscal stimulus should help fund pent-up demand from consumers who are exhausted by isolation and freed up by vaccines and now warmer weather. Arkin, who's a voting member of the Policy-Making Federal Open Market Committee, said the U.S. labor market took about a decade to recover from the Great Recession, but will likely see less long-term damage this time with a quicker turnaround. That's because, he says, job losses over the past year have concentrated in sectors like housekeeping, food service, where workers change jobs regularly and could transition to similar roles in other industries more quickly. Barkin said that parents, especially mothers, who left their jobs to care for children after schools and child care centers were shut down to prevent the spread of COVID, could help the economy provided they have the right skills and reliable internet connection. Birkin worries, however, that if parents who left the workforce don't return, that will have long-term negative implications for potential growth in the U.S. And speaking of Jerome Powell, one more time, he said in a radio interview this morning that powerful fiscal help from Congress combined with accelerated vaccine distribution has allowed the economy to rebound faster than expected. At some point, he added, that will allow the Fed to dial back the help it's provided over the past year or so, though he said now is not yet that time. Powell said, and I'm quoting here, as we make substantial further progress toward our goals, we'll gradually roll back the amount of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities we've bought. As we know, in the wake of lockdowns just over a year ago, the Fed cut its Fed funds rate to near zero and has been buying at least $120 billion of bonds and agency notes every month since then. Congress has approved more than $4 trillion in stimulus and relief over the past year, looking at another possible $3 trillion or more in future spending on infrastructure and other areas. Powell called Congress's current fiscal practices unsustainable, though necessary in the face of the crisis we're in. Back over the past year, Powell said he has no regrets about the extraordinary measures the Fed took, even as some critics worry that the amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus could prove troublesome down the road if the economy overheats. There's that inflation fear again. Ultimately, Powell said, in a crisis, I think what we did served its purpose, staving off what could have been far worse outcomes. Here's the thing about that, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not sure the U.S. will ever reach its dual goals of full employment and steady, if rising, inflation. For one thing, unemployment is closer to 12%, not the 6% the government tells us it is. For another, actual inflation is hovering around 6%, not 2%, as the government says it is. So the first thing the federal government and its agencies and the Fed have to do in their quest to be more transparent is to tell the American people the truth. The truth about where our leading economic indicators actually are, and not perpetuate the lies about unemployment being 6% and inflation too. In my humble opinion, that would be a good place to start. I hear some music. That means we're going to head into a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. talkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody in the office taking care of customers. Call us at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188, or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com. Now, in 2020, as the world literally convulsed under COVID-19 and the global economy faced its worst recession since World War II, billionaires saw their riches reach new heights. We've been talking about this a lot lately. But because we see new reports and studies and surveys coming out weekly, sometimes more than once a week, with different angles, we think it's important to keep this forefront in our mind. Now, some billionaires are reportedly talking to their wealth managers about how to keep a hold of and consolidate their fortunes amid the global fallout of the pandemic. Others are discussing how to preempt and navigate demands from governments and the wider public to pick up their share of the recovery costs. The plans being discussed by the ultra-rich range from philanthropy to shifting money and businesses into trust funds and relocating themselves and their families to other countries or states with more favorable tax laws. In the U.S., the election of Joe Biden and anticipated higher taxes for the rich have in particular triggered a sharp response and demand from clients to set up trusts. That's according to some of the larger wealth managers. This would allow them to pass along money to children or other relatives under the current $11.7 million tax-free threshold per person. During his campaign, Biden proposed a return to 2009 levels when that exemption stood at just $3.5 million. Forbes, which tracks publicly known fortunes, estimated billionaires had gotten 20% richer in 2020, that is. The author of that said there's been a massive shift in the conversations we're witnessing among families in terms of the consideration of social equity. She said this has led to the younger generation pushing this topic at the board level. Also seeing a surge in clients partnering with groups like the UBS Optimus Foundation, which channels money to causes such as Action Against Hunger, where donations rose 74% last year versus 2019 to $168 million. Well, I guess you could call that one consolation, if somewhat minor in the whole scheme of things, to the growing inequity around the world. Now, here's a particularly sore subject, because when this pandemic ends, certainly a lot of us want to get back out there, whether we live in the country, in the suburban towns, or in the city. Pandemic-induced fear, economic hardship, domestic discord, racial strife, and a continuing influx of guns has helped propel the urban homicide rate by a record amount last year. A drumbeat of dire reports about rising crime has left city dwellers justifiably concerned. It's according to the report's authors. This is done by Arnold Ventures. It's a philanthropy focused on solving societal problems, along with the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice. They say anti-violence programs should be a priority in the waning days of the pandemic. Relation between communities and police should be mended, they also recommended. And street outreach workers should be hired and deployed to help diffuse tensions. In a sample of 34 cities, homicide rates were almost 30% higher in 2020 than in 2019. That's a jump that represents an additional 1,268 lives claimed by homicide. Prior to 2020, the biggest single year increase in the murder rate was 12.7%, and that came in 1968 at the height of those race riots back then. While the three largest cities, New York, LA, and Chicago, accounted for a disproportionate amount of the rise, higher homicide numbers were seen in cities both large and small. One consolation to this alarming trend is that residential burglary rates actually dropped by 24%, according to the report, and drug offenses by 30%, although motor vehicle theft did rise by 13%. So far, the elevated murder rate has carried into the new year. Tally of homicides in 2021 by the FBI has found a rise equating to more than 20,000 murders a year for the first time since 1995. Now, that's annualized, of course, in the first 2 months of this year. Nobody knows for sure why crime rises and falls, but poverty and economic insecurity seem to be the key drivers. And thus, the author suggests that's what needs to be focused on by policymakers over the long run. All right, we don't hear about this much in the mainstream media. Still, you hear it here in this program. But there's a retirement crisis on the horizon in the U.S. It continues to get bigger. And very little attention is being given to it. But look, as this crisis gets bigger and closer, many Americans' retirements could be on the line. And by many, I mean millions. Now, these days, we hear plenty about what happens with hot stocks, rising treasury yields, and investors debating whether cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are the future. But in the midst of all this, we've been overlooking what's happening at pension funds around the country. And as it stands, a large number of pension funds, both private and public, are severely underfunded. In other words, they don't have enough money now to pay out to people who've been contributing and who will qualify for benefit payments in the future. City-run pension funds around the U.S. don't have enough money. State-run pension funds don't have enough money. Private multi-employer pension funds, they're at critically low levels. All told, it's estimated that as much as $162 trillion, yes, trillion, in unfunded liabilities exist in the U.S. today. Imagine what will happen if you've been contributing to a major pension plan for decades, and when you finally reach your retirement age, you find out you only get a portion of what you contributed. 50 state-run pension funds have a funding gap of at least $1.2 trillion. Those pension funds only had 71% of the assets needed to pay their future benefits. According to the American Legislative Exchange Council, which looked at more than 290 state-administered public pension plans recently, the unfunded liabilities stood at $6 trillion. Now, what's happening with pension funds is like a slow-motion car crash. It's not perceived as a crisis right now, but it could impact the retirements of millions of Americans in the coming years. In the recently passed American Rescue Plan stimulus relief package, about $86 billion was allocated to prop up private multi-employer pension plans. But that's just a drop in the bucket that was added to the bill to guarantee enough votes for passage. If over the next decade, pardon me, if over the next decade, two or three, unfunded liabilities of pension funds grow much larger, will they be so big that local, state, and even the federal government won't be able to bail them out? This has profound impacts for millions of our neighbors as they hit the retirement age in the coming years, and for the economy as a whole. We can't continue to sit around with our heads in the sand and just do nothing about this. Over the coming months, Melody and I will be presenting some of our ideas for dealing with this impending fiasco. Now, if you have cable TV, you may have seen that the chief executives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter appeared this afternoon before Congress, this time to answer questions about extremism and misinformation on their services. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Google's, actually their parent Alphabet's Sundar Pichai, and Twitter's Jack Dorsey were last seen testifying before the joint hearing by two subcommittees of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Lawmakers began the hearing by criticizing the social media platforms for their role in the January 6th riot and in the spread of COVID-19 vaccine misinformation. Committee Chair Frank Pallione said, Your business model itself has become the problem, and the time for self-regulation is over. It's time we legislate to hold you accountable. Both Democrats and Republicans on the panel criticized the tech giants for what they see as efforts to stifle conservative voices, among other issues. Some lawmakers are calling for Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That's the federal law that shields online platforms from liability over user content to be scrapped or significantly reformed. And notably, Joe Biden reportedly agrees. Now, Zuckerberg argued that Section 230 should be redone to allow companies immunity from liability for what users put on their platforms only if they follow best practices for removing damaging material. So we'll see. Who knows where this hot air will lead to, ladies and gentlemen. I just know that far too often in the past, Congress has responded to heated controversies of the day with bad policy making, particularly unintended consequences. So, you know, let's not wait too long, but let's take time to think this through and come up with something better than what we have now. Nearly 50% of Americans now say the stock market is rigged against individual investors. That's in a new survey from Bankrate.com and YouGov. The solid majority of those investing in the stock market, 56%, believe the market's rigged as well. Now, underlying these results is widening wealth inequality, where young people in particular just may not have a sense of hope or fairness in the markets. That's according to Bankrate's chief financial analyst, Greg McBride. He added that the recovery we're seeing is very much a K-shaped recovery. Well, thank you, Greg. The fortunes of some are worse than ever. The fortunes of others are better than ever. In addition to the growing wealth inequality seen since last year, people are also talking much more about the subject. Just 13% of those surveyed disagreed with the idea that the stock market is rigged against individual investors, and just 5% strongly agreed. Those with higher levels of education were most likely to agree that the stock market was rigged at 58%. Apparently, those with higher incomes were also more likely to agree, 53%. From households with income of $50,000 or more said the market was rigged. Now, certainly the GameStop frenzy over the last couple months with the notion of squeezing the hedge funds or other institutional investors
and the idea of individual investors banding together to go up against whomever they perceive as the villain, that could certainly be a consequence of that sentiment. In the remaining minute or so, let's talk about this new study. Now, I know that immigration is a sensitive subject for many of our listeners, but it does continue to be an important and contentious issue in our country, and certainly an issue on the forefront today with so many more thousands of unaccompanied minors coming to our border. So when new relevant information comes out, I think we at least ought to mention it. A new report from the Minnesota Chamber Foundation, Chamber of Commerce, shows that Minnesota's growing immigrant population is a major force in that state's economy. The report released this week details the undeniable benefit that Minnesota's 470,000-plus foreign-born residents contribute to the state. Immigrants tend to be younger than the general population, and they enter the workforce at higher rates than native-born residents. And immigrants in Minnesota make up 10% of that workforce, up from just 2% in the 1980s, with spending power totaling $12.4 billion. We'll end on that note, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure coming to you today. Melody and Butch will return tomorrow. I'll be back on Tuesday. Be on the lookout for a weekly blog in your email inboxes tomorrow. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening, and please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I got me a wealthy man.